This podcast is part of the MyPodcast.com network. Go online right now and get your very own 100% free podcast, MyPodcast.com.
Welcome to episode 2 of the CDC podcast. I'm your producer, Randy Ma, from the blog Graduate School Gamer. This week I have some new individuals for the cast. I have Dennis Farr from Vorpal Bunny Ranch. Hello, Dennis.
Hello.
Alex Myers from the blog Show and Tell.
Hello.
Roger Travis from the blog Living Epic.
Hi.
And Eric Swain from the Game Critique.
Hello again.
So when we last ended, we were talking about ludonarrative dissonance, and to review, why don't you define what that term is, Eric?
I think it was first attributed with Clint Hocking when he was talking about Bioshock. He thought it was going to be a one-off. Well, the critical community, or at least we, sort of took the term and started applying it to many other games. It basically revolves around the idea when story or narrative elements don't seem to match up with gameplay or mechanic elements, and they seem to be odds and going in different directions with what they're trying to present.
So when we last stopped, we were debating whether ludonarrative dissonance was something that games needed to fix, or it wasn't that big of an issue.
I think if you're trying to push the medium forward, it is sort of an issue. But the way it comes out is that I think that when it does happen, it's that you have different people working on the story, you have different people working on the mechanics who maybe don't converse or don't try hard enough, or budgeting comes in, or scheduling comes in the way. And that I don't think that it can't actually go away. You just have to alter the story or alter the mechanics, more likely the story, because it would be easier to work with. And it is sort of a problem.
Roger Travis speaking. I think that actually Hocking and Iroquois Pliskin, I don't want to say got it wrong, but I think they underestimated Bioshock, which is the game that all of this came out of. But I don't believe that it was unintentional on the part of 2K in Bioshock, because I think what Hocking and Iroquois Pliskin both talked about was the way that it seems like there's a difference there. The story and the gameplay are at odds in Bioshock, but I think in the end, if you're looking at Bioshock the way I think is most helpful to look at it, in fact, that dissonance actually adds to the meaning of the game, that in fact the player is supposed to feel the dissonance and supposed to learn from that dissonance more about what the game means.
Well, what was their contention for Bioshock originally?
Well, I think what they were saying is that the idea that you get the same amount of Adam, that is, I don't know, gameplay energy, if you will, from harvesting the little sisters and from saving them means that, in fact, the story where you're supposed to be making a fundamental ethical choice between being a good person and being a bad person, to put it very broadly, that story is out of whack with the gameplay mechanic, because, in fact, the designers didn't want a player's gameplay to suffer if they made the ethical decision as opposed to the quote-unquote unethical decision. My own reading of the game is that, in fact, in the end, the player is supposed to realize that whether you harvest the little sisters or save the little sisters, that is, whether you're ethical or unethical, it doesn't have any real effect on the world. And that the choice to be ethical or unethical has to be made on a different basis than whatever rewards you get.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, I haven't finished Bioshock, but when the first couple of times when I was confronted with that choice, whether or not to harvest or to rescue the little sisters, I mean, you know, the first time I let her go, the second time I took her, and I noticed that, okay, it doesn't matter what I do, really, because I get the same amount of Adam from her either way.
I really have to agree. That seems like a different sort of issue with Bioshock, and I think that's why a lot of the poster child for ludonarrative dissonance is actually switched to the Gears of War series. To me, that's a much better example where, and we talked about it last week, where the gameplay and the story, or at least the idea and concept behind the game, don't seem to match up.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, it's in a game where there's clearly a lot less thought being put into what the overall thematic meaning of the game is going to be. You're going to find instances where things could be a lot better, and I agree that Gears tends to be one of those.
I don't really understand why that's such a big deal in Gears of War. To place such emphasis on the cover system, yet be such a giant kind of soldier, seemingly invincible. I mean, that to me, it didn't seem like it was really a break in the kind of behavior I'd expect from someone that was in a battlefield, regardless of whether or not they were wearing power armor or, you know, or whatever.
I think the difference was the narrative of the game constantly pushes you to push forward and to be rah, 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 whereas the cover system constantly forces you to reevaluate your system, how you're going to approach the problem, which I think I talked about this on my blog, was the fact that for me it made me actually step back and look at the entire naming system of that game. I mean, you're called a cog, the entire game is called Gears of War, to where really you're nothing but a tool in the entire game. So it gives that sort of dissonance in terms of you're sitting there and you're supposed to be sacrificed at the same time you are playing a human being.
Also, it doesn't really matter because the general quality of the Gears of War story doesn't really makes you try not to notice it. There was one section in Gears of War 2 when they're at the abandoned research facility and when they're trying to escape, you have the Razor Rain coming down or whatever they called it. And that, to me, was the, if it, totally inane, it was the best sequence because you couldn't quite just run out to your enemy without being bombarded and slaughtered by the rain. It was a reasonable assumption that you had to stay where you were, take cover, shoot them at a distance, and make your way around through a complex system of covers and half-broken roofs. And that, to me, was the best sequence of the game because that's when what you were doing and why you needed to do it matched up.
From what it sounds like, it just sounds like we believe that ludonarrative dissonance exists, but we don't necessarily agree with Clint talking that it's a negative aspect of a game. Because to directly quote his blog, when he wrote about Bioshock, he said, "By throwing the narrative and lytic elements of the work into opposition, the game seems to openly mock the player for having believed in the fiction of the game at all. I don't think we believe that it actually mocks the player. It just causes the player to reevaluate the situation and reevaluate the game."
Yeah,
I do, and I think that's what its purpose was, and I was glad that it did mock me when he, spoiler alert, when he does tell me you've been following this instructions. I don't actually think Bioshock had ludonarrative dissonance. To me, it all seemed to flow, maybe not on the surface level, but on an underneath level, everything did flow, both mechanics and the story.
For Hawking, the primary problem was the fact that we're dealing with Randian objectivism, and it was supposed to be a choice between freedom and power and all these other various elements, which the game never really had. So the dissonance was, no matter what choice you made, it was all really the same game.
Well, but wasn't that 2K's comment on Randian objectivism, right?
Well,
that,
exactly.
Yeah, that's why I don't believe it had ludonarrative dissonance. Gears of War, on the other hand, did, and I was very ambivalent about it.
Yeah, I guess what I would say is that it's something that we are going to be increasingly aware of as more and more complex games emerge. I mean, 10 years ago, it almost wasn't possible that there would be such a thing as ludonarrative dissonance. Now it's going to be a question of whether you use it effectively or it detracts from your game.
It seems like this is something that's been done before in games. And for some reason, I have in my mind some LucasArts adventure game that did this. But did it as like just more a comment on the fact that you know you're playing a game. Like it's taking you out of that immersion in the story, and
I think some of the Monkey Island games.
Yeah, that's I think it was
to you and wink
two
from time
kind of
to time.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, does that count as ludonarrative dissonance, or is that just sort of yeah?
I think ludonarrative dissonance ends up being too grand a term for that kind of thing. I mean, I would say that Zork 3 did a lot of that as well.
The problem I have with the adventure game series and that is Hawking tends to base this on mechanics. So it'd be the question of whether the mechanics support the game system itself, or the narrative system itself, rather.
Mm-hmm.
So it's when the mechanics are in opposition or are not directly in tune with the narrative. So with the LucasArts games, they might be metagaming at some point and mm-hmm. sort of poking fun at that, but that's not necessarily a dissonance.
Why? If they're breaking the synergy between the mechanic and the story.
Does it ever actually break the mechanics? Do the mechanics never support the game itself? I'm trying to think of it.
Yeah, I guess I see what you're saying. If it's a more general break where it doesn't seem so obvious, then where it seems like just bad design.
Yeah, because that seems more like an in-joke, tongue-in-cheek sort of thing. I'm just thinking of Day of the Tentacle, and the adventure games are very slow-paced, and the mechanics support that more slow pace of acting. If there was a need or a sequence in the narrative for Twitch gameplay for like a quick combat sequence and you still had the mechanics of the adventure game, I think that would be ludonarrative dissonance, but just calling attention to what you're doing is more of tongue-in-cheek humor. It really is just like a quick joke, and it doesn't break the immersion as much as like a whole break of mechanics.
So wait, let me say something here for you, Eric. Do you think immersion trumps ludonarrative dissonance, and they can't be one and the same?
Or to put it another way, does ludonarrative dissonance always break immersion?
I'm not entirely sure, because I have very few examples of the dissonance, because most stories are about, or at least most games coming out, are stories of go there, shoot these people, and the mechanics support that. I think in more complex games it's going to be more obvious, but in the few examples that we have, I think that it may not always break the immersion, but it lessens the experience.
How about we look at Grand Theft Auto 4, where they have this social aspect for the game, but when you're not doing that, you're killing people left and right. So you're making friends with other characters, you're making relationships and connections, and like right after you have like a date, you go and run someone over.
The thing is, there are people that do that, and I see that more as a character, Nico Bellic's character, than anything else, that he is this divergent and almost schizophrenic character.
Yeah, that's the way I took it. I mean, it always struck me whenever that happened, where I'd get off from a date and get a call that I had to go kill someone. It felt dissonant, but I don't think it felt kind of ludo narratively.
It seems to fit the backstory of the game.
I seem to recall when first started writing about it within the critical blog, so to speak, there was this whole, that Nico Bellic's story was very reluctant to get back into the world of crime, yet you couldn't really advance in the game unless you did. The mechanics supported you progressing in the game through these violent acts, through crime, but it always felt like Nico was resisting that. So the ludonarrative dissonance there would probably be, you could probably make a case for it, that it's actually an interesting narrative design in terms of character development.
That it's productive ludonarrative dissonance, that you feel there should be a way for him to just stop, right? Like Godfather 3 with Al Pacino saying they keep dragging me back in, right? You feel like there should be some sort of gameplay path. And there is. I mean, you could just go and drive around Liberty City. But then, I mean, it ends up being the same thing as Bioshock. You could, spoiler coming, after you kill Andrew Ryan, you could just run around that small space for the next 5 hours or however long you wanted to without putting the little thing into the little machine. But you're not going to do that. And the fact that you're not going to do that is exactly the same reason that we have to go on with our lives.
I also have to argue that, because he did say, would you kindly put it in the machine? And you don't, and it was already explained after you say, would you kindly,
oh,
you don't have a choice.
Well, exactly, you don't have a choice, but you do have
but
a
it's
choice, right?
But it's narratively explained that you're going to put it in the machine regardless.
Oh, I know, but you could turn off the game, right? But or you could fail to put the thing in the machine and just run around that space. With the rapture is not going to be destroyed. Or at least, I mean, I have not made the experiment of not doing it for 3 hours and seeing what happened. But if you want the story to continue, if you want to participate in the game, you do have to do that. And obviously it's because he said, would you kindly? So it's the same with Nico. Nico can't play the story unless you're doing this stuff that Nico can't get out of. And I think that that's a reflection on the compulsion that's part of the human condition, I guess.
Well, Travis McGill just joined, if anyone's still listening right now. We also lost Roger Travis. Sorry.
Prince of Persia, it has a very serious case of ludonarrative dissonance, but only if you play it a certain way. If you just play it and just move through the game, don't do any explorating, don't go back to old territories, the narrative of that you have very little time to save the world from Ahriman and you're on a ticking clock makes sense. But then if you just decide to goof around and jump around all the little nice scenery, get all the light seeds, suddenly you're realizing, why am I doing this? The demon is never going to come out unless I go fight him. He will stay in prison forever. I could just jump around forever.
So there's no, like, there's no timer?
But many games don't have that. You don't really have that in Fallout 3 until you activate certain key elements of the story.
It can be used effectively in open-world games, you know, where you trigger like a side mission or an adventure, and then a counter starts. But if, like Eric's saying, that if the whole game is based on this idea that you have this limited amount of time to save the world, and yet it's an open-world game, and you can just jump around and explore stuff, and there's really nothing in the gameplay itself that is pushing that idea of the story, then I would say that's just bad design.
And I've always contended, if this were a linear game, and like parts of the ceiling, which does happen in the game, just fell around you and collapsed some of the track so you can't backtrack too far, that would have made it a much better game, because it would have had it would have given an implicit, if not an actual timer into the game, but that you just couldn't just wander around. You'd have to go on to this, you'd have to just keep pushing forward up until the end.
Here's something I've sort of been thinking about. With this break between game mechanic and story, it seems like it's happening a lot because we have these game designers or game companies, or however these decisions are made, seem like they have this expectation that what's intriguing and popular for players right now are these big open world games, like GTA 4 type games. But what's traditional with a lot of games is that there needs to be a story. And stories by nature are very linear. They have climaxes, they have anti-climaxes, they have builds, you know, there's all sorts of little twists and turns. And are we noticing that this sort of dissonance more because it's harder to tack a linear storyline onto a non-linear mechanic? So are these sorts of breaks and dissonances just evidence of a kind of transition in the evolution of game design? Because, you know, like we've had all of this tradition of very linear adventure story type games, and now they've kind of realized what they can do, or at least what they can really be, is very open and interactive.
Yeah, I think we'll probably see more games go towards less linear story, a broader story, so they can use the prose of games more.
I think the thing that's probably most limiting us is the idea that a game has to end, that the story has to end. The games that do this best, have the best emergent storylines, tend to be MMOs, games that do not end, games where you create your own character, and if you want a story, you create it based off of how that character develops.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was, that was my next thought, is like, you know, and I'm only having this because I've been playing it all weekend, but I've been playing Burnout Paradise, and I'm really intrigued by how they've taken this really compelling racing game, because I love the Burnout series. I mean, they essentially took it and put it in Liberty City. They took out all of the carjacking, the third-person body character story stuff, gave you a car, and then you can just ride around and do a bunch of races or try to take down people and have all these little challenges. There's no story, I mean, other than what you make yourself as a player, and it's one of the most compelling games I've played yet on the 360.
Sure, and I think like Michael Abbott was talking about with theater and gaming being more closely linked than film and gaming, that they basically try to set the stage for the players, and then the players are kind of the actors in the world.
Well, and I think the other iteration to consider there is the fact that with a play, you have a basic storyline that you're going to get no matter what, but that presentation is going to be different depending on who's on stage and who's presenting. Which is very much what we see in games. You and I can play Fallout 3 and have wholly different experiences.
I have a feeling, though, to go back to an earlier point, of how they try to, of the point of them trying to get it right, of an open-world game with a linear storyline, I think that actually misses the point entirely, because we as people have always have dealt with linear stories in almost every medium we've done. Books, films, plays, they're all a linear narrative. Games offer a new type of narrative where it doesn't have to be linear, but it still has a beginning, middle, and end, but it's always going to shift. And I don't think open-world games have fully realized what they can do. They just sort of offer breaks in between missions that is still basically a linear narrative.
I was going to bring up Zelda. That's a fairly early open-world game that has extremely linear narrative going on in it.
That's very true.
Hmm.
I was just playing the I was playing through Link to the Past on GBA and getting insanely frustrated because I was told exactly where I needed to go and exactly what I needed to do, but I got into the dungeon and I couldn't do it. I couldn't figure out how to find some big key. You know, I kept getting mauled by skeletons, and so I left thinking, okay, maybe I have to go to this other dungeon first. And I just ended up wandering the map for like 3 hours, not really progressing anymore within the narrative, but exploring, you know, to my heart's content.
But was there a type of urgency needed?
I felt fairly urgent. I mean, you know, I really wanted to get back to that other dungeon and progress the narrative, because the narrative just stops. You know, there's no side missions, little quests or anything to kind of fill in the sort of frustrated breaks maybe that you might have. I mean, I ended up going to GameFAQs and figuring out how to get it, but...
That's why I've never really liked the Zelda games.
So does that count as...
wandering around.
Yeah, I mean, I guess does that then count as ludonarrative dissonance? It seems like it should.
I think that just counts as a very difficult game.
If it's a break in how the mechanics support the story or vice versa, I think that kind of fits the definition we've laid out.
Well, that's the thing, is like it doesn't have a written definition because we're still trying to figure out what constitutes ludonarrative dissonance. What you described, I don't think that fully constitutes it. I think that might be bad puzzle or bad level design, but it doesn't sound like the actual workings of the game change the story rather than just stop it.
Or maybe I'm just stupid and couldn't figure out how the dungeon worked.
That's what I was thinking.
It could just be user error.
I think it's more just a ludo dissonance. That sounds like maybe a breakdown in gameplay mechanics, but I don't think it necessarily shows where there's a schism between the narrative and the gameplay mechanics.
Mm-hmm. However, if there was like a very large urgency, like the world is going to blow up in 10 hours.
Well, that's what it was.
And then it doesn't.
That's what it was. I mean, that's the whole premise behind the Zelda games, is that the world's going to end, and you have a very limited amount of time to stop it from ending. So you have to collect all these keys or stars or coins or, you know, pots or bushes or whatever, gems.
But are you given any indication of how soon, or is just said soon?
It's more or less just said soon.
Because, like, only right. Ocarina of Time or Majora... No, or is it... It's either Ocarina or Majora's Mask that gives a straight-up number of days.
Majora's Mask.
Okay, and that's but the thing is, you can keep doing it over and over, so it takes out. But it doesn't even have to give a number, but at least an indicator of, like, so you can judge the time. Final Fantasy VII at the end does this sort of thing where right before the last fight with Sephiroth, it's like a meteor is going to hit the planet, but right before the last battle, you can turn around, go straight back to the world, start breeding your chocobos for hours on end, and this meteor will never crash into the planet. That, I think, is ludonarrative dissonance, because you can go back, do whatever the hell you want, even though you've passed the threshold of the world is going to be destroyed soon, and you're given a very strong indicator of how soon, and then nothing happens.
But I mean, if the definition of ludonarrative dissonance is that broad, aren't we basically saying that any game that has an end toward which we're being pushed with any sort of urgency, and we don't have that urgency restricting us, that we're essentially going to run into ludonarrative dissonance? Because I think one of the appeals for open world games is the idea that we can do anything. I know I've played Oblivion I've started it at least 4 times now, and it's the same with all the Elder Scrolls series.
What if, like, a game doesn't have a specific written down quest ahead of time, but could have multiple written down quests depending on how you have a beginning? It leads you to several different middles, which then will lead you to several different ends. That seems a much more cohesive idea of the open world game two story, and any linear narrative in an open world game itself could be considered ludonarrative dissonance.
But you're just describing multiple linear narratives, Eric, imposed on an open world. So I don't think it really solves the problem. I think even Fallout 3 did a pretty good job of avoiding that, since it kept the world-ending quest until, you know, very far along into the narrative. So it gave you some time to explore.
Yeah, but I'm wondering, if do you even need the world-ending quest in these games at all? Can't you just have a smaller problem to do? Or is it because you make this world so large, you feel the need to create a story that has implications just as large?
Okay, so we seem to be trailing off on ludonarrative dissonance, talking more about narrative structure and not gameplay mechanic, which is like more important, because it seems like, Eric, you really concentrate on like the narrative system and how it's structured and how that relates to game mechanic.
Well, it's because I have the feeling most designers know how mechanics can work. They don't seem to quite get on how to make the narrative work. Maybe not with the mechanics, but at least for the mechanics. Because everyone talks about how, why can't the mechanics fit with the story? Maybe we should be looking at the other way around, as how can we make the story fit the mechanics that we already have? And I have a feeling that's the part that designers don't have down yet.
Are we kind of talking about a chicken or the egg sort of situation here? Like,
yeah, sure.
Which should come first, the story or the mechanic?
Generally, it's like which comes first, but even after you've created them, you still have to keep editing both sections. I think it could actually be either or, depending on the type of game that you're playing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it needs to be the mechanics, since we are talking about games.
I'm sure there are exceptions to how you do it. Like, the thing is, a lot of mechanics are already laid out. Maybe not completely programmed on this system or that system, but you have all the mechanics that you know of. You can create a story and then choose out of all the mechanics that have come before, jumping, over-the-shoulder shooting, first person, third person, whatever mechanics you have, and then choose the ones that you think could fit the story and fit the game like that.
Yeah, and I think that's a lot of times where the ludonarrative dissonance comes from, but I think we're looking at it a little bit too broadly. Usually, in at least the articles I've read, people are picking out a very specific mechanic and showing how it creates a schism between the gameplay and the storyline or the narrative.
I think it's because it's how games are made. You create you have a system that you want to make this game about. You want to, just for example, you want to create a over-the-shoulder third-person shooter, and that you have all the little tropes, maybe a few innovations or a tweak here that you want to make, and then you have to attach a story to that. You already have all the mechanics and the gameplay that you want it to fit with. Then you just make up a story that goes with it, but maybe not put enough effort to make the story match the mechanics.
What I think Travis is more pointing out is that the cases for ludonarrative dissonance so far are not that the entire game fails on the ludonarrative dissonance. It's normally an aspect or two. Clint Hawking's complaint about Bioshock was the harvesting of the little sisters in contrast with the Randian philosophies. Most of our looking at Gears of War as a ludonarrative dissonance game that has ludonarrative dissonance is the cover mechanic versus the entire story of pushing forward.
Or
but this is to assume that we want to stamp out ludonarrative dissonance, which I'm not sure we necessarily want to do. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Bertolt Brecht in theater, and his entire idea was you want to expose these dissonances. You want to make sure that people don't get too engrossed in the story. That way they take a moment to pause and actually look at the story. They don't just go with it and lose themselves in the story and not think about it.
So intended ludonarrative dissonance could be a good thing as long as they're using it as a tool instead of just being completely unaware.
Yeah, if it's an element of game design and not a result of just poor design, then yeah, it's a good thing. So I mean, it, as much as I hate to say it, it feels like it's coming down to authorial intent.
Yeah, but Dennis, what you've described there, it has to be authorial intent, and I have a feeling that, but before you can make that decision to deconstruct the idea of that you don't want to be pulled in, you have to first construct it before you deconstruct it, and I think games are only just getting to the point where you can call it, maybe not immersion, because many games have done that, but immersion of a complex and thematic, well, intricate story.
But the thing is, that assumes a model where the only author is the designer, the design team itself, whereas I believe that we as players provide a lot of that narrative ourselves. It's why it's very difficult to call a game racist or sexist fully. It might have those elements, but it's up for the players to at some point step in and see how they react to that. At what point do they interact?
Yes, I think maybe games have less authorial intent, but there is still going to be authorial intent to any matter. It may be less pervasive and it may be less noticeable, but it is still going to be there. And the player has more input in this medium than any other, but I don't think you can completely eliminate an authorial intent.
Well, and I don't think we ever will eliminate authorial intent, but it's hard to say how much authorial intent we can pay attention to, especially if we're providing some of the authorship ourselves.
but that only really works for open world gameplay. A linear game, that's going to be almost completely authorial intent.
I don't think so, because you're still creating, you know, your own story as you play through it. You're creating what Corvus has talked about and constantly make blog posts about, the fabula, however you say it. You know, it's your story that you've created through your experience of whatever medium you're experiencing. It's uniquely yours, and it just has to do with how you've traveled through that medium. I mean, I think even with extremely linear games, you still get that.
Maybe that's the balance, is like how much authorial intent and how much player intent is effective in the story. But I think the player is going to have more influence in an open world game, and the author is going to have much more influence in a linear game.
Well, to tread away from open world games, because it seems like we are starting with mechanic and going to narrative. And I know Tim Schafer starts off with narrative and then goes to mechanic. And if we look at many adventure games, such as Phoenix Wright or Hotel Dusk or Sam & Max or the many I could trot out right now, where narrative is the key concept of those games, do we see little narrative dissonance in that?
No, because I think the narratives there are a lot slower paced. And the slower pace matches the slower pace of the mechanics. But also for the Phoenix Wright series, is like the mechanics were set down by the first game, and then you have 2, 3, and 4 are using the basic same mechanics and just authoring their own new stories, new cases for them. So I have a feeling that they understand what stories will work and what stories won't with these mechanics, and creating them as they needed them.
Well, it makes me wonder, for instance, Lee Alexander recently tweeted the question of whether or not The Path was a game. If adventure games had come out now instead of at the beginning of the medium or relative beginning of the medium, would we consider them games? Because a lot of people are hesitant to call The Path that necessarily, though I think most of us are willing to at least accept it as a game.
I think we should not go through this path again of discussion.
Yeah.
Oh, for the record, I just want to say I have admitted that Passage is a game.
So we have not found an instance of dissonance in these adventure games, correct?
Well, all the old adventure games, they used the same mechanic over and over. They used a system of mechanics and just maybe dressed up the items, maybe dressed up some of the deco to make it fit the style of the game. But it was a case of writing a story for the mechanics and not both at the same time or mechanics for the story. And I think that is what we're comfortable with. We're comfortable with writing a story to a certain set of circumstances, because that's what novels are, that's what movies are, that's what we're used to. But when we're trying to create mechanics for a certain type of story, that's where we run into trouble because we haven't done it before. I think it can be done, and maybe we will be able to do it.
But I don't think necessarily ludonarrative dissonance is about whether a mechanic has been done before. It's just what would necessarily be the goal of the narratives in an adventure game, and does the mechanic that exists support or hinder that? I mean, if we could say adventure games, and I'm pulling this out of my hat, adventure games want us to explore a narrative and unlock a narrative. Does the, for instance, classic LucasArts little talk to move to use mechanics, do those support that, or does it actually hinder it?
I think they do support it to a certain extent, but I think that there's probably actually more dissonance in a lot of the old adventure games than in more recent games. Just even something as small as inventory. I remember when I started playing King's Quest VII, that was one of the first adventure games I got. I was constantly wondering how the two female characters were carrying, the 15 huge objects in the inventory. So that the inventory mechanic would be an example of dissonance with the narrative.
You know, it's diegetic and non-diegetic. Things that can be explained throughout the story and that belong within the narrative world, and then you have the things that are the operations of the game that you need to just play the game, like the start menu and the buttons and the load screen and anything that is constantly reminding you that it's a game. And you know, elements like what you're talking about, Travis, are examples of non-diegetic, like the HUD, the heads up display on in any game that has one, which is pretty much all of them. I don't think they're examples of ludo dissonance, because a ludo narrative dissonance. I don't know. They're such a common convention that we just accept them. This whole sort of discussion around ludo narrative dissonance just kind of seems like a moot point.
I don't think ludo narrative dissonance is such a big deal, because dissonance has always been a part of games, and I think it's necessary. If we look back at the old, like, pawn games and the 8-bit games with the abstractness of it, I don't think immersion is such a big problem.
I think ludonarrative dissonance is damaging when the story is complex, is intricate, and is trying to be important, like it was in BioShock. And the story was, unfortunately, it failed. It was trying to be important in Gears of War 2.
But I think, I mean, this is just one of those. It's a tool to use in terms of telling a game's story. Much like every other medium has its own tools, you can write in a way that you're paying very close attention to the structure and are able to create dissonance in what a person is reading with what the story is at the time. So I think this is just one of those instances of, again, as you said, authorial intent, whether the author is aware of what's being done or whether the author is completely missed the point and is just implementing something that passes by him or her.
Yes, but the thing is like you're saying it's a tool, and even if they are trying to make a point, if I tried to make a point by keeping out speaking modifiers in my dialogue for my stories, and it worked, then yes, it makes the point. But however, if it doesn't make the point, it doesn't land, it actually it confuses the people, it causes problems in accepting the story, then yes, maybe it was authorial intent, but you still failed, and it caused the dissonance.
But that's something every author faces, whether or not he or she tells a story that fails, that has the intended effect. And ultimately, it's up to the reader to determine whether or not the author failed. So in this case, it would be up to the gamer.
So I guess I feel like that's sort of what is happening the only example we have really is BioShock. You know, and I think maybe Roger Travis was reading into it a bit much, but I tend to kind of agree with his sort of idea that with BioShock, it's more that you're meant to feel that dissonance, that the moral choice is not based on reward, you know, that you shouldn't get more of a reward for making the right decision, you know, than if you made the wrong decision, that either decision gives you the exact same effect, and so neither decision really helps determine your morality. That morality comes from somewhere else, and maybe that's what they were trying to do, what they were trying to say.
I always thought that was what they're trying to say, and they messed it up by not fully explaining you're going to get the same amount of Adam either way. You get the same amount of Adam by Tenenbaum when she compensates you with the extra Adam. That's how it evens out. You do actually get less when you harvest, but you get compensated, so it all equals out at the end. I have a feeling if they just made either way, maybe just make it a process of time, like it takes longer to do it the good way, but you get the same amount of Adam, that would have been better because it takes the mathematical equation out of it, and it would constitute a much more moral choice because it would be much more obvious that it was just a moral choice and not one of economics.
Well, it looks like that's what they're trying to do in the second one, where you adopt the little sister and you actually have to work for the Adam, or you can harvest them and just take it. But we'll see how that works out. That's not the point that Clint Hocking made, though, with his original post. He only briefly mentioned the choice between harvesting and saving. He's talking more about the choice, how they give you that choice, but then they take away the choice to choose between helping Atlas and not helping Atlas. And that's where the ludonarrative dissonance happened for him.
But the thing is, it's explained that isn't a choice. That there is no way that is a choice, because...
But see, that's where he's saying is the fact the game sort of builds itself on the fact that you're trying to make choices, and that based on a Randian philosophy that you're supposed to be making these choices, you're supposed to have that power of choice, but ultimately you really don't.
Well, the whole idea of BioShock is how Randian objectivism in the end is an app fails because of the human condition, and I think you could see that this also is a failure of the is a failure because you can't make a choice.
My big problem with BioShock was it was the same exact twist that they had in System Shock 2 and everything else as well. I mean, they just threw that in at the end, you know, to kind of make up for it. Is the impression I got. There was, you know, that Deus Ex Machina at the end of the game to kind of wrap up the threads, uh-huh. But the player going all the way through the game sees the dissonance that's there. I mean, whether they explain it or not at the end in an acceptable fashion to the player, I don't think matters, but because the dissonance is still there.
is it's the concept of, is it a bad thing or is it a good thing? And I think with a complex story like BioShock, or an intricate story, one that actually is, that's the main focus. The mechanics are not the main focus. They all stem from what you're able to do in the world that came from the story of this revolution and the civil war that happened in this place. And why it tore it apart so badly was because of all these things that you can use as weapons. But it's still all fundamentally based in the story. And when a problem occurs between what you can do and what the story is telling, when it's so firmly based in the story, I think that's when it is a problem. For something like, not Tetris itself, but for something that like Tetris, so firmly based in the mechanics and a story's tacked on, no, it probably isn't a problem. If like a ludonarrative dissonance were to be found in an adventure game, I think that would be a problem because they're so firmly based on their story. I think it may be what the focus is, and as more and more games try to find a balance between the two, it is going to become more of an issue.
Have we discussed ourselves into a corner? I think we've exhausted this for a bit.
I think so.
Yeah. It is kind of a tiring discussion, but we haven't figured anything out. I think that's obvious.
Well, I think that about wraps it up. I would like to thank Alex, Eric, Dennis, Travis, and my apologies to Roger Travis, who got disconnected. I'm sorry about that. You can continue the discussion by visiting us at IRC under the Freenode server. The room is GB Confab. Check out the show notes for our blogs and the articles mentioned in this podcast, and subscribe via iTunes. See you next week, and thanks for listening.